I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello from the Heartland. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. News when it matters and why it matters. Our Smarter series features unique people who help us think and live smarter. We constantly hear about COVID-19 as an invisible enemy. So how can you gather the insight we need to fight an enemy that until recently we never heard about or even seen? You turn to someone like our next guest, Dr. Michael Lin, a doctor two times over. He has a medical degree from UCLA and a PhD from Harvard Medical School. He now is the principal investigator for Lin Labs at Stanford University's School of Medicine. Just plainly speaking, Dr. Lin's specialty includes examining things up close, like viruses, on the molecular level. And that's how he's able to provide what I would describe as a forensic analysis of COVID-19. He profiled the virus in a PowerPoint presentation entitled How to Fight the Coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 and its disease, COVID-19. Let's start there. COVID-19 is the disease. The virus that causes it is actually SARS-CoV-2. But we're all just sort of using COVID-19 casually. Dr. Lin says we should think about this new coronavirus as the movie sequel to the virus that causes SARS. This sequel has some major similarities to the first. In fact, it's 96% identical, but it also has some key differences. And that's where we started our conversation. Because there is a 96% similarity to the original SARS virus, what do you think the average layperson should know about what that means for them and how they should live accordingly to protect themselves and their family?
Right. So there are positive things from knowing that the viruses are similar. So those positive things are, this is a class of viruses that's actually relatively fragile. It's easy to kill. It doesn't survive. It survives in the environment, but it's limited in how long it can survive. And also that all the drugs that we already know have some effect on the original SARS virus are likely to have an effect on the current virus. There's also one thing that one should not generalize, and that is, as we mentioned earlier, the SARS-1 virus is more lethal than this virus. So there's less of a concern from a lethality point of view. But also the current virus is more contagious, and so one has to be more careful in avoiding its spread so that it doesn't infect the more susceptible members of our population, which are the elderly,
Well, that's been one of the burning questions for so many about how exactly this is spread and how long precisely it lives on different surfaces. You have an entire slide dedicated to how do you kill this particular virus. And so I was wondering if we could kind of walk through that. For example, you know, are you wiping down everything that comes into your house? You know, I'm thinking about Amazon boxes. I'm thinking about a carton of milk. I'm thinking about anything that we bring into our house. How do we apply combating this particular virus to our own lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. I am currently wiping down things that come into the house that are touched a lot by other people. I think it would make sense to actually wipe down the outside of things that you get from the supermarket, actually before it gets into your car, because those could have been touched by many, many people. For example, if they're touched by the supermarket cashier, we put them on the supermarket self-checkout counter. Those are surfaces that are touched by hundreds of people before you. So, you know, I would then treat those things as potentially contaminated, and I would wipe them down. I think if you're getting deliveries from like a Amazon delivery service, it comes in a cardboard box, and we know from the studies that I quoted in my slides that the virus doesn't live very long on cardboard. So I wanted them to worry too much about that. Also, the virus couldn't even come out of cardboard. So I think in those studies where, you know, scientists have put the virus on different surfaces and then seen how much of the virus is left afterwards, they're really trying to, they're scraping up the virus to, after certain amounts of time, to see how much it lived on different surfaces. And we're talking about cardboard right now. So, you know, cardboard is very absorbent. The virus will get into the mesh, the wood pulp mesh of the cardboard. It's unlikely to come out. So I wouldn't necessarily wipe down cardboard, and then I would just assume the things inside are clean. But certainly if one wants to, you know, use soap and water or Windex on anything that comes to the house, that would make it extra safe. I think the problem with all virus epidemics is that it's all a matter of probabilities. And, you know, as humans, it's really difficult to think in terms of probabilities. You know, there's a risk of injury or death in many of the things we do, but if we're familiar with it, we're comfortable. You know, crossing the street, we're comfortable with doing because we feel like we can control the situation. You know, we riding a car, we're comfortable. Those things, however, all carry some risk. Right now, the risk of getting the virus from a random person or an object that very few people have touched is very low. The current infection rate is still less than 1 in 1,000 people. But, you know, 1 in 1,000 is also not, it's not a low number in terms of the overall number of people in the United States. And so it's hard sometimes to think about probabilities in that range. And 1 in 1,000 is sort of where things might start affecting you. The more you do, the more chances you are, you get of encountering the 1 in 1,000 occurrence. And so it makes sense to take preventive measures. It makes sense to sort of treat things as if they might be infected. But anything you do is beneficial, right? So you could just focus your energy on those things that are more likely to transmit the disease, which are things like things touched by many other people, being in a very crowded space with a lot of strangers. You know, those are relatively high risk activities, high risk things. It depends, basically.
Yeah, no, and we're hearing such a wide range of different estimates, for example, for how long the virus lives on different surfaces for different periods of times in different environments. On a molecular level, what is the most effective way to combat the virus with the common cleaning agents that we have?
Okay, yeah, right. Yeah, so you mentioned different surfaces. So I guess we should just describe that for people who might be interested. So smooth surfaces like metal and plastic, you know, allow the virus to be transmitted more easily, because the virus, once it falls down on there, is more easily will more easily move from that surface onto your hands. An absorbent surface like clothes or paper towels, you know, the virus is going to get trapped. It's not going to come out. Also, if the virus dries out completely, it will eventually die. It will die quickly if it's completely dried out. So cold humid environments tend to be good for viruses, which unfortunately is what much of the country is experiencing right now. So we're still in early spring and it's still pretty cool and humid. So among these different surfaces, that's why it might make sense to decontaminate or clean the ones, the things that you get that are metal or plastic. Fortunately, those are easier to clean. You can just put soap on them and wash them in your sink. And that's what I do for a lot of things.
Is that enough, Dr. Lin? Just doing a simple act like that? Do you not need any, you know, high-powered bleach?
Oh, right.
To really, really kill it? I'm just curious.
Right. No, this is a really good question. And it's one that's very confusing for the consumer. Soap and water are enough. You know, for this virus, they're enough. You know, we're told to wash our hands with soap and water because that's enough. We're not told to dip our hands in bleach afterwards. That would be overkill. So the confusing thing comes when you go to the store and you want to buy some cleaning agent, and you can read the labels of these disinfectants, and they'll say kills 99% of household germs and, you know, bacteria and viruses. And you think you have to get the disinfectant that contains bleach, or they're called quaternary amines. You know, they're chemicals that when put on surfaces will kill living things. It's not necessary to go that far. Anything that's soapy will kill this virus. So that means your hand soap, your bar soap, your shampoo, Windex, all those things are soapy. And they're soapy because they have detergent. The scientific name for that is surfactant. And we know from the basic biology, the basic structure of this virus, that it's torn apart by detergents, by soaps, by surfactants. The virus is enclosed in, you know, something called the plasma membrane. It's the same enclosure that our cells have. So basically, this is a very fragile membrane. It's only two molecules thick. And the way soap works is by dissolving this membrane. So this virus will literally be dissolved by anything that's soapy. And so we don't have to really go all the way to these very powerful disinfectants like bleach, quaternary amines that basically kill everything on contact.
Wow, just sort of imagining what the virus looks like is so helpful to understanding how to combat it, because we're sort of inundated by these antibacterials and these bleaches and all these different things to tell us this is what we need to stay safe. But just understanding that it can break apart with what sounds like a soapy lather of any soap, Dr. Lin? I mean, could it be just a regular ivory soap or
any soap?
Any soap. Yes. That's so right. Fascinating. Okay. Right. That's really helpful. You know, you mentioned the temperature, and we've gotten a lot of questions about that, about seasonality and how it might apply here, sort of like the flu. What does past precedent with SARS tell us about how outside temperature could impact this virus?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. The unfortunate thing about SARS is that I think it was contained fairly rapidly. And so I'm not so sure that we have a great idea of seasonality in SARS. I would also be hesitant to generalize from SARS for that particular characteristic, because we already know that SARS and the current coronavirus, SARS-CoV-coronavirus 2, spread rather differently. So, you know, the current virus is much more contagious. So something in that 4% difference between the genomes is responsible for the very different behaviors we see in people. I don't think we have enough knowledge of SARS, because it was such a limited disease, to really predict how the current virus would be. But I think the studies have been done on SARS. One virus temperature sensitivity, and it is temperature sensitive. You know, if you raise the temperature 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you get a large reduction in the survival of the particle on surfaces. You know, and temperature, of course, makes things rot faster, and that's because all the chemical processes are faster at higher temperature, including the processes that cause decay. And so this virus is just literally going to decay faster at higher temperatures. So I think there is going to be some benefit of warmer temperatures, at least in terms of, you know, keeping, as long as we don't air condition everywhere too excessively, you know, then the higher temperatures outside will translate to average higher temperatures inside, and that should help kill the virus and lessen its spread. But it's not going to be, sufficient. It's not going to be sufficient by itself. It's going to be helpful.
Got it. So it's not a panacea. It's not suddenly going to evaporate in front of us once we get into the summer months, which I think, you know, the CDC and health officials said that was very wishful thinking. But there has been that question about whether or not we'll have a season for this. What, again, going back to the molecular level of this virus, does one become immune to a virus like this once they have it?
Yes. Yes. You are immune. You know, you'll make antibodies to the virus, and then and that will prevent you from getting disease from the virus, even if you're re-exposed to it.
Again, just looking at your research, and you've extrapolated a lot of data, and obviously your own experience working with molecules of all sorts of interesting things, Dr. Lin, I think that's fair to say. What do you think is the right thinking right now about this virus? Do you think that this has been around for a long time, and it's in a lot of people have been exposed, and we're sort of just seeing the infection rate go up? Or what's your gut on that?
Right. I mean, yeah. So fortunately, we don't use my gut. There is a lot of data.
I forget who I'm talking to. I know we have some limitations of the data, so I don't want to overpromise, you know, to our audience. At the same time, I want to rely on your expertise. So whatever we should rely on, Dr. Lin, we turn to you for your thoughts on this.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, of course, we know that the virus started in China in December, and its sequence was published by Chinese scientists immediately. So the good thing is we live in a molecular age. We can sequence viruses, anything, very quickly, very cheaply. And as you know, the virus spread through Wuhan and then from there to the rest of the world. The first cases in the U.S. were found in Washington, in the Seattle area. And the sequence of that virus shows that it's the same virus that came from Wuhan. And that was in mid-January. And so you may remember that Wuhan authorities closed the city, prevented people from leaving the city in late January. And so probably before the city was closed, someone from Wuhan traveled to Seattle. And so that was now 2 months ago. And in that time, the U.S. has been very slow to ramp up testing. And it has basically been doing just a very small number, a handful of tests on people who showed the symptoms and had travel history or contact with somebody from China. That turned out to be much too limited, because there's now, the latest thing I've heard is that the virus was probably spread by somebody from China in the Seattle area, you know, since mid-January. And then we're only now seeing the effects of escalating spread. So one thing that people have to keep in mind is that the virus has an unusually long incubation period. So the average time from being infected with the virus to showing symptoms is something like 4 days, which already is on the long side, but then it can be as long as 3 weeks. The vast majority of cases fall within 2 weeks. But this is a virus that can actually linger for a while before it starts showing symptoms. And so that's been a big problem. And also the number of deaths lags the infection by about 3 to 4 weeks. So, you know, it doesn't kill people right away. And so there's this month-long delay between when people get the virus and when they die, if they are going to die. So speaking of deaths, the current best estimate for your risk of dying from this disease is 1%. So 1% of people who get infected, unfortunately, will die of the disease. That's a very high number for a virus that's contagious. You know, it might seem low, in the sense that anyone who gets it has a very high chance of surviving, so that's good news. But it's very high in a public health sense if a lot of millions or hundreds of millions of people get the virus.
And would you expect that? Would you expect that hundreds of millions of people will get the virus?
I hope not. I don't think it's inevitable. It would be inevitable if we did not take public health measures. But the public health measures that we're putting in place now, so you know, limits on gatherings of people of 10 or more, and in the Bay Area, complete stoppage of work. These are effective in preventing the spread of the virus. So depending on how long we're willing to do this and how well coordinated we are, we can keep the virus infection numbers, at least this year, to manageable levels, maybe in the tens of millions rather than 100 million. But anyway, to complete the answer to the question you asked, what we are seeing now is this long delayed effect, right? So we have the death numbers you see are the result of infections that happened a month ago. That was a long time ago. And then the virus continues to spread, but mostly undetected. And it can spread, it can double at about the rate of 1 week. That is, every week we see about twice the number of infections a week before. But then there's this long delay between this exponential growth of infections and death. And so these are things that are happening around us that we don't see. And that's what I think is making people nervous. But it's something that we just have to keep in mind.
Is that making you nervous?
Well, I mean, I've crunched the numbers, so I know what to expect. And so it doesn't make me nervous when I see that the rates of death are doubling every week. It's just what people who have studied the situation expect. But that's also why it's important to clamp down now on the spread of virus, because we don't want to see the numbers continue to rise a month from now.
That's something that really hit home to me reading your research, is understanding why now matters, not for 10 days from now.
Yeah. I mean, now matters because the virus expands exponentially, meaning it has this doubling of doublings, right? So a week from now, if we did nothing, we would have twice the number of people infected as we have now. 2 weeks from now, we'll have four times. 3 weeks from now, we'll have eight times. It just doubles every week. And that's because the virus is spreading through a immunologically naive population. That means a population of people who have no immunity. And so the virus has free rein to spread. And so it will double every week. Now, if we don't take measures now, by the time we see a lot of people infected that we know, it will be too late. Because, again, the infections that happen now result in illness a week later, and in death for 1% of the infected 3 to 4 weeks later. So there's this, we have to think ahead, basically. And we're fortunate at this time because of various things. And we've had time to prepare, and we've had time to look at how the epidemic has spread in other countries. So we know the characteristics of the disease. We know how easy it is for it to spread. We know things like the doubling time. So this allows us to make predictions based on the small amount of data we've had in the U.S. into the future, and to see what would happen if we did nothing. And we see that if we did nothing and this doubling happens every week, then by May, 30% of the population will be infected and millions of people will die. And they will do so in a situation where the hospitals are overflooded with severe cases that need respiratory support, and there wouldn't be enough ventilators for everyone who needs it. So that's a situation that we're seeing playing out in Italy. By the time they noticed a lot of infections, it was already too late to prevent the flooding of the hospitals with severe cases. They've managed to clamp down just in time, meaning the situation in Italy is really testing the limits of the hospital system, but haven't yet gone beyond those limits.
How effective do you think we can be at this point with the social distancing? We've been told at this time of this interview, we still have another 2 weeks where the federal government doesn't want to see gatherings of 10 or more people. And as you mentioned, different efforts on a state or even a local level. Just looking at the data, how effective can that be, in your opinion, to change the course of what could be our destiny if we don't take those measures?
I'll answer it in as simple a way as possible. There are a variety of outcomes that can happen from social distancing, and it really depends on exactly how careful people are. In the Bay Area, we've banned people going to work except for essential industries, and to shelter at home. If everyone really did shelter at home, then there would literally be no way for the virus to get transmitted. But we still have some activities that we have to do, like going to the supermarket, which I find is a very high risk activity, especially since more people are going to the supermarket now than before. So I think it's actually critical that people also engage in careful sanitary habits, things like cleaning objects given to you by others, avoiding crowded places, keeping your distance from strangers. So these are things that will help. How much will they help is really hard to know. And that's why we actually need to try these measures, see how the infection rates react for the next month. There's this there's this number called the R-naught number, which is simply the ratio of people who get the disease for every infected person. In other countries, it ranges from 2 to 3. Usually three without any measures at all, and 2 in countries where people have already taken measures. In the U.S., actually, we're less packed. We're less congested and crowded compared to most countries in the world. So numbers for this infection ratio, this R-naught number, from countries like China or Korea that are more crowded, maybe overestimates compared to what we would get in the U.S. naturally. However, the R-naught number in the U.S. is probably still 2 or greater. And that means the virus will still continue to spread from person to person. If we can take measures that reduce that number to less than 1, that means then 1 person who has the disease will give it to less than 1 other person. And that means the disease will eventually die out. So the goal is to get the R-naught number less than 1, but as low as possible, because the lower we get it, the faster the disease will go down to small levels. The big worry, actually, is not that social distancing won't be effective. I think everyone believes it will be effective. But the big worry is, how long do we have to keep social distancing in place? Because the moment we relax it, the virus is going to come back and go through that doubling of it once every week again. So the hope is that we'll have some treatments or vaccines for sort of the next big round of infection.
And do you see those treatments and vaccines being effective against this virus? Because you know so much about how it looks at on a molecular level, do you see those treatments being potentially very effective, slightly effective? How do you see it?
It's a good question. I think the treatments will probably be something on the order of 50% effective in preventing deaths. So that's still not fantastic, but it's certainly better than nothing. So in the presentation that you've seen, I talked about treatments and vaccines. So they're different. So treatments are for people who already have the disease and are doing badly and who might die. So in that case, you want to have drugs that work on that limit the replication of the virus. There are currently, I would say, 4 drugs that have some proven activity against the virus. And the first one that has the best evidence for it was just announced to be effective by a Chinese organization yesterday, and that is an antiviral protein. Antiviral medicine that was developed for many different viruses, including the flu virus, and its scientific name is favipiravir. And so this is a drug that was just announced to be effective against the COVID-19 disease in controlled trials, where it dropped the number of patients in a hospital requiring ventilators from 17% to 8%. So that's a 50% reduction in severe symptoms. So that's great compared to having nothing, but it's certainly not going to be a cure-all for everybody.
Maybe we have to save even just thinking about treatments and vaccines for another conversation, because it seems that we're a little bit off, but there are some potentials out there. And without overwhelming people about things that maybe they're not going to have access to in the immediate, I was just curious about how this is changing the way that you're living and how you're giving advice to your loved ones.
Yeah, I would say, unfortunately, it's not changing. We have to act currently as if there is no vaccine, because we need to keep the numbers of infected people down. You know, the drugs, like I said, they're being proven. They're going to be available fairly soon. But again, since they're not going to cure everyone, you don't want to rely on the drugs alone. The vaccines, as they become available, may indeed stop future epidemics, but they probably won't be available until early next year at the earliest. That means we have at least another half year to go before we can really let down our guard. So in that time, we really do have to be very careful in limiting the spread of the virus.
One of the things that I appreciated so much about your presentation is that you did put a bullet point that said, this is not the zombie apocalypse,
right?
which I actually really needed to hear, Dr. Lin.
Yes.
But why is it not the zombie apocalypse? We need to just let that kind of roll over us a little bit as we're considering all the different possibilities.
Yes, right. Yeah. So there are some nice things about the disease. I mean, the disease is terrible, but there are some nice things about it that people don't know, that not really being communicated effectively. So first of all, 50%, at least 50% of people who get the virus never show symptoms, or maybe show symptoms that are so mild they don't even realize they have anything other than a mild cold. But these people still clear the virus. So examples of this are children. So we know that children hardly show any symptoms. They have mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. They have immune systems that are somehow geared to fight the virus very effectively. And so the younger you are, the less you're affected. And so 50% of the population, again, basically don't even know they had it, but they become immune. So that's good. And then of those who do get the virus, about 10% require hospitalization. The number goes up as you're older. So if you're over 70, that percentage is probably something like 50 or 60. But for 90% of people who actually get the disease, they don't require hospitalization. So that means overall, something like 95% of people who get the virus don't require hospitalization. They either don't have any symptoms or they can recover in a few days at home. So that means that this virus is not going to bring vital industries to a halt. So it's not the situation where people are dying and, you know, fields don't get picked of crops and, you know, truck drivers can't drive their food to, you know, distribution centers and supermarket people can't work. You know, nothing has to close because of this virus. We're closing things now to prevent the spread of the virus. And again, the spread of the virus will make some people sick and will be really bad for older people. But for younger people, for most of the workforce, it's just an inconvenience.
Dr. Lin, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much, Jen. I really appreciate it.
Quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news, a refuge from the storm. I'm Jenna. Thank you for choosing smarter.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.